Thank you for joining us for Dialogue Today. I'm Chrissy Kuiper, and this is WUOT. Today, our topic is the 2020 U.S. Census, the results, what they mean, how it affects our daily lives. We have three guests today who are studying those results, and in just a moment, I'll let them introduce themselves, and then we'll get into the discussion. In the meantime, if you have a question for us, you can message us on Twitter. You can use the hashtag WUOTDialogue. You can send us a direct message, or you can message us on Facebook at WUOTFM. I'd like to welcome our three guests. Would you introduce yourselves? Stephanie, would you start, please?
Good afternoon. I'm Stephanie Bohan. I'm a demographer and the head of the Department of Sociology at the University of Tennessee.
Nicholas.
Thank you, Chrissy. I'm Nicholas Nagel, and I am professor and head of the Department of Geography at the University of Tennessee.
And Tim.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. My name is Tim Kuhn. I'm the director of the Tennessee State Data Center, which is housed at the Boyd Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Tennessee.
Tim, since Stephanie and Nicholas are pretty self-explanatory professors and heads of their departments, would you explain what the data center is and how you sort of fit into UT life?
Sure. Well, the state data center is actually, there's actually a state data center in every state and every U.S. territory. They're housed typically in governments, in state governments, or a lot of times in universities. And it's a collaborative, perennial and collaborative relationship with the Census Bureau, where we work with data users across the state to help them just use census data, access it, make it available to them. We provide assistance as a resource when someone has a question, right? You might even think of us sometimes as tech support, like if I'm looking for this, how do I do it? Or is this an appropriate way to use this type of information? And we also put out some of our own analysis and some of our own tools on our website, which is tnsdc.utk.edu. So that's the first one, the first aspect of our relationship with the Census Bureau. The second one is a little more technical. We work directly with Census Bureau staff in something called the Federal State Cooperative for Population Estimates. And so in that role, we're Tennessee's designee to work with the Census Bureau to provide them information that goes into the annual production of population estimates for and housing unit estimates for cities and counties. And it was formed to help provide consistent submissions from every state to ensure that the population estimates, which in every year that doesn't end at zero, are the official estimates of populations in the country, to make sure that that data is consistent and reliable from every state and to improve the accuracy of those.
How long have those been in existence?
State data center, both of them have probably been in existence for 40, going on 50 years, especially in the case of the FSCPE. So it's been around for a good number of years, but it gets a little bit busier when the decennial census updates come around.
Sure. Understandable. Well, let's get into the data. First of all, something I thought was interesting was that nationally, there were more than 65% of all addresses that were counted by self-response, which is a pretty large number compared to what we've seen in the past. Can any of you comment on that? Please, Stephanie.
So of course, we want people to self-respond to the census, right? We want to send out the census and we want people to send it back because it costs us more money to collect data if people don't self-respond. But this year was the first year where people could just go online and fill out their census form. And people are used to doing that kind of thing now. So we've made it as easy as possible and perhaps easier than ever to respond to the census, and that has helped both reduce the cost of administering the census, but also improving some of the counts.
Does it help with the fear of the census as well, to have it be a little more accessible in that way, that you can go online, you don't have to meet anybody face to face? Does that?
For some people, I think certainly it does. But the census did a lot of studies leading up to this about how the online mode would change things. And some people are actually a little bit disconcerted, you know, when they get that letter from the census and it knows exactly who they are, it seems, from the beginning. Yeah, it's strange. A lot of people, I think, were actually a little bit leery about doing things online, and it had this idea of encroachments into their personal lives, perhaps more than before. But it did seem to work. We've been watching demographers, and anyone collecting survey data has been watching response rates for not just the census, but for all surveys, declining for decades. And so this is the first time in many decades that the response rate did go up, and it was almost entirely because of that online mode. So it seems to have helped.
So was that in every state? Do you happen to know if it was, you know, if we saw a rise in Tennessee as well, or was it just overall a national number?
I think one thing I might say is I'm one of the things that I think benefited online response in general to the 2020 census was the extension of the response time. And a lot of that came as a result of COVID-19 impacted operations for the Census Bureau shutting down, but also just kind of life in general slowing down for a few months. Mm. The initial, you know, end of responses was supposed to be several months earlier than it ultimately was, and that it created an extended response time where that really went almost into the end, towards the end of October. That time fluctuated quite a bit as the census went on, but towards the end of October, and I think that really helped provide a lot of extra time to generate additional responses and to convey the urgency of the importance of getting a good response from everyone across the country.
Okay, well, we've talked a little bit about, you know, how, as you say, the extended time, which honestly, I wonder if the Census Bureau will use in the future. Is there, I'm not sure about the law, is there a law that keeps them? Does it have to be an extraordinary circumstance to get them to extend that response time, such as a pandemic? Or can they just decide?
Tim, do you know when the first numbers have to be reported to the president?
The first numbers have to be reported by January 1st of the census. 2021 was the date when those numbers were supposed to be delivered. They ultimately weren't delivered until I think it was April 28th. So they came about 4 months later. And so that there was an extraordinary circumstance, and I think that was probably a one-time thing in mm-hmm. terms of that delay. There are a lot of downstream things that happen once that apportionment count is released, as far as the data that gets compiled and sent out to local government. It also was delayed, and there, you know, and that's creating some issues where districts that might normally, for instance, in city council elections, which occur in the same year as the census data comes out. Normally those districts are redrawn by the time that election occurs, and this year it didn't happen. And that also impacts some state, other states as well. So I think this is a one-off thing. I don't think that you'll see that extended collection time occur again in the future.
I agree with that. Extending has two effects. One is the census is supposed to be the population of the United States on April 1st. Of census year. And so people move around a lot. Americans are very mobile, perhaps less than we used to be, but Americans are very mobile. And so when you extend it, when you're contacting people out in October, it becomes much harder for the census to figure out, okay, where was this person actually living back on April 1st? And so that's one reason why the extension confuses things. But the other one is there's a lot of processes, data quality, data assurance checks that have to happen in the census right. when data come in, making sure that people aren't double counted, for example. And so it was pretty much impossible for that to happen between October 1st and when the data were supposed to be released to the president by January 1st. And so I don't think we'll ever see October again.
And it also, of course, it affects redistricting efforts. We, you know, I have a very shrunken time to get county redistricting happening across the state. And, you know, the legislature is going to take up that plus other, you know, congressional redistricting in January. What I saw, let's see, hang on just a moment. I gotta go to a different screen here. There is a the Census Count Question Resolution Program. So when does that usually happen in the general scheme of things in the past? Is it still happening for this one?
It is, in fact, hasn't even started. So it will begin probably after January 1st. We don't even have the final Federal Register notice on exactly what all the scope of the Count Question Resolution Program will include. So the details of it are still forthcoming. And so this time between when the data was released on the August 12th and January 1, it's a kind of a little bit of time to just kind of catch your breath and look at the data and take get a sense of what it looks like. But we'll be preparing to look at things like how group quarters populations were counted. And group quarters are places like prisons, jails, nursing homes, and college fraternities, sororities, and dormitories. We'll be looking at that. I think communities will be looking at their boundaries to see if counts, if things were counted in the right place, if there were missing large quantities of missing housing units. That's something that every community will probably start gauging and getting familiar with as they go through the redistricting process, and then consider a challenge if needed sometime after the first of the year.
And of course, what I read about that is that it doesn't really affect apportionment or redistricting. It just affects other things, I guess, like funding perhaps, or yeah, okay. All right, so some of the results that we have seen, one of the biggest, other than that, you know, there were more people who actually participated this time around, we saw a continuing trend of rural to urban migration. You know, the metro areas grew in Tennessee nationwide, but we also saw more people responding that they are multiracial. So let's talk a little bit about that, because that was not just nationally, that was in Tennessee as well. A lot more Tennesseans are describing themselves as white and other, or black and other, or Latinx, or yeah. So Stephanie, tell us what you know about that.
There's a couple things going on here. I mean, one is, for many iterations of the census, you weren't allowed to be multiracial. At least you weren't allowed to report that you were multiracial. So if you were mixed race, you had to pick. And there's actually some good reasons to force people into those choices, because then it might get at maybe the race that you're treated as. But we have shifted to allow people to select more than one race. And so and then what we've seen in this census is, yes, many more people selecting that they are mixed race. And that's kind of an artifice of two things. One is, we think there are genuinely more mixed race people in our population, but also that people are becoming more comfortable reporting that they are mixed race. So I think you're seeing both of those things, right? So some of it is that the population has genuinely changed, but some of it is the population really hasn't changed. What's changed is how they're reporting themselves.
To follow up on that, a lot of the popular press been seeing is about how what we call the white alone population in the United States has declined for the first time. And so, as Stephanie said, when someone gets the census form online or in the mail, they can select multiple races. And so for the first time ever, the people that selected only white actually declined nationwide. But when we look at all the people who said white and something else, the population of white people in the United States is still increasing. Not as much as many of the other races. So there's been a lot of racial angst I've seen in the last few weeks over this changing demographics. But it doesn't, this is a trend that has been going on for a long time. And there doesn't seem to be, I think, much, we shouldn't be depending on how you look at things, we shouldn't be, let me back up. It doesn't appear that the racial composition of the United States is under a dramatic restructuring, and the problems we have seen with racial biases will continue as we know them, and we should still be aware of the racial problems going on in the United States.
Oh, sure. I mean, I feel like that goes without saying in a lot of ways, but it is interesting, and it will be interesting to see how more people comfortable talking about and identifying as multiracial, that's definitely going to change things in the future, I think, for sociologically, for all of us. I mean, for the nation as well, I'm hoping. I'll cross my fingers there. All right. So one of the questions that I have about this is, how do these numbers affect what goes on? I mean, how does that affect our daily life, except for the knowledge that we live in a more diverse society? Anybody?
Well, I'll start. Yeah. The federal government sends an enormous amount of money to states and to local governments based on the census. And it's over $1 trillion, I think, now is allocated to places and to states based on the data that come in from the Census Bureau. And so the amount of funding received is enormously impacted by the results from the Census Bureau. And so that's perhaps one of the first and most important ways that I think these data impact people daily. How much money we get for roads, how much money Tennessee receives for Pell Grants and for federal student aid, how much money Tennessee receives for Medicare. All of these things are determined by the population counts. And so we're not aware of all the ways in which they impact us, but we absolutely are using these services that are given to us based on the count for Tennessee or for places.
And I guess a couple of things I'll add there. So I live in Campbell County, and it's had a fairly sizable decline since the 2010 census. But, you know, when the 2010 census came out, Campbell County had declined by about 500 people, which doesn't sound like that much, but the county had to really scramble to make up the shortfall in federal funds. And, you know, and now with the county losing another 1,500 people, the scramble is going to be that much worse. So rural counties really rely, so do urban counties, but really, really are dependent on federal money that they get as a result of census numbers. And so the numbers matter a lot. But I will, one of the questions you asked was about, and this is related, was about the changing racial composition. So we know that certain groups of people tend to be undercounted, right? Are not counted in the census.
Right.
And, you know, Latinx and Hispanic people are particularly undercounted. And in most census years, there is a huge effort to make sure everybody gets counted because, you know, local areas want and need all the money that they can get. This census was the first time I remember ever seeing certain groups actively working to try to keep certain people from being counted. And so there were efforts targeted at the Latinx and Hispanic communities to get them to scare people from filling out the census, to say, oh, you know, you're going to get this, and if there are people in your household who are unauthorized, they're going to come after you. Don't fill out the census. It's too dangerous to fill out the census. And so places that have large Latinx and Hispanic populations really suffer from that kind of undercount and these efforts to keep the undercount of some groups high.
So no, that hasn't changed. That's the way it was with the 2010 census as well. There was sort of a movement to keep that community from being reported. Is it more, I mean, it sounds like, I hadn't even run across this, but it sounds like from what you're saying, it might even be more blatant than it was the last time around.
My assessment is it's great. Great deal worse and more more organized efforts with the 2020 census.
Just the year before the 2020 census, we were seriously considering whether or not to add a question to the census on citizenship. And that did not happen, but that was very well known among certain immigrant communities. And it had a, it certainly scared certain people and caused a loss of trust in the Census Bureau.
Right.
And so even though it didn't appear on the census, we think it had an impact, a negative impact on response rates among some communities.
What can be done to alleviate that the next time around? I mean, I don't think there is still talk about a citizenship question on the census. That was taken away. There were lawsuits filed. I think both of those actually against the federal administration have been dismissed at this point. But yeah, go ahead.
Nicholas and Stephanie can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of the primary objections to the proposal to include the citizenship question really stemmed from the fact that the impact of putting it on the form hadn't been studied. And that is not something to be taken lightly. Everything that goes on to these forms is studied, the order of the questions and where boxes are placed and the size of the boxes and the number of boxes. And all of these things are tremendously impactful. And as we can see in the 2020 census, there was some additional boxes that gave people who were white an area where they could write in some information about their ancestry or origin, you know, whether they were Lebanese or Middle Eastern. That kind of gives us some suggestions that were, and there were some additional boxes that were added as well. And that was all studied prior to the census getting underway in 2015 and in 2018 in Rhode Island in an actual test. And so it's not to say that this question is going to go away, but I think if it ultimately would be considered for inclusion, it would need to be studied to see what its impact is on the types of responses that you get and the response rate.
The Census Bureau thinks about these, like the impact of the citizenship in two ways. One is, can they do better marketing? And I think the marketing and trying to market to specific communities and to create that level of trust in the Census Bureau.
Yeah.
The marketing before the 2020 census, especially to immigrant communities, was, I don't think, as effective, or it came later than it did in previous decennial censuses. But something else that to me is really interesting that happened in the Census Bureau is when they were told to create the citizenship question, the Census Bureau people inside suddenly asked, can we trust our own data? Can we trust the rest of government with our own data? If they're asking us to produce data that we think could be sensitive to people, is there any way in which we can protect respondents? And so the Census Bureau created a whole new set of technologies in which, rather than releasing certain numbers, they're actually adding random noise to certain numbers for certain places. It's called differential privacy, and they're really on the cutting edge of this, and there's a lot of problems. But it's a radical new way of publishing data. And the reason why the Census Bureau is doing this is because they don't want to ever again be in a situation in which they're asked to publish data that they think could be really damaging to people.
That is fascinating. We have to take a break. But when we come back, I want to hear more about this differential noise. That's really interesting. And I can only assume that's going to come into play more and more and more as privacy concerns become more of a concern. You're listening to Dialogue on WUOT. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. Quick break, and then we'll be back for the discussion. Welcome back to Dialogue. Our topic today, of course, is the U.S. Census and the results that we're looking at and how those results are used. And our guests today are three people from the University of Tennessee: Stephanie Bohan of the Department of Sociology, Nicholas Nagel of the Department of Geography, and Tim Kuhn with the Tennessee State Data Center at the Center for Business and Economic Research here on campus. So before our break, Nicholas, you were talking about differential noise. And one of the things, of course, that is going to make people feel better about their privacy and how this information is used and who has access to these answers and the data that come from the U.S. Census is, it sounds like this is kind of a game changer. So tell us a little bit about this noise and how it works.
Sure. So suppose you live in a city block, and maybe there were 100 people who said that they were white and 10 people who said that they were Hispanic, for example. Previously, you would have been able to download a table and you could find your block and you could say, look, there's 100 people who are white and 10 people who are Hispanic. But for the first time now, they're no longer publishing that data. What they're actually doing is they've got these really tricky, complicated algorithms that actually add noise to that. So rather than having 100 white people in your block, maybe now it's 112. And maybe instead of having 90 Hispanic people in your block, sorry, I said before, I can't remember. Maybe instead of 90, it's 93. And so they're adding noise to almost every single number that's published. And if they do that right, then in theory, it would be much harder for people with really big computers to crank all this number and try to figure out who's who. There's a lot of concern that it's not that easy, and they're still trying to figure out the methodology for doing this. But it is a game changer in how they're thinking about people's privacy and about how they're thinking that census data that we used to think was safe may actually not be safe because they're just releasing so much data. A lot of people are concerned about this as users because now they're getting data with noise.
Well, that, yeah. I mean, I can see from a research and a purely statistical standpoint, that would be really confusing and hard to deal with, though I predict that all of you will get better at dealing with the noise as that practice goes on. Stephanie, we broached the subject of how to improve the counts and how to get people to respond and what that will take. It sounds like that is, you know, this noise and this way of protecting privacy is probably one of those ways. What else is there? How else do you think we can improve people's participation in this?
I think there were three major challenges to the 2020 census. So one is that for many years, right, Congress wouldn't approve a new budget. So we operated under continuing resolution. And so typically what you have is you have an increase in funding to the Census Bureau in the run-up to the census. And that didn't happen for this census. And so funding for the 2020 census fell below funding for the last three censuses prior to that.
Wow.
And so, you know, the jury is still out about how good the quality will be of the 2020 census. So that was one problem. So obviously, fixing that, which will require, Congress actually passing budgets, but also doing a run-up next, going up to the next census to give Census Bureau funding that they need to do advertising and things of that nature. The other issue we ran into is, your biggest on-the-ground effort are state and local complete count committees. And so these are groups of people who get together and they know a lot about local communities and they know how do you reach these people, how do you reach these people, where are going to be our problems, which neighborhoods are undercounted, how can we reach them? And there were places like Texas where, normally it's just we're coming up on the census, we need to form a complete count committee. And for the 2020 census, Texas legislature said, we're not going to form a complete count committee this year. And so those complete count committees matter a lot. Knox County had a great one and they did a lot of work. But then the third thing that happened with the 2020 census was COVID, right? And so this reduced the amount of on the ground effort that could be made. But it also, it's questionable about how that impacted things like counting college students, right? Because normally the 2020 census, the census comes out and college students who live in dorms get counted as part of the group quarters population.
Right.
But, in March of 2020, when all the students got sent home, now their usual residence isn't necessarily Knoxville. It could be, Memphis or Nashville or whatever. And so if you look at this year's, if you look at the numbers that have just been released, it looks like Nashville has exploded. Knoxville has grown, but not as much as maybe you might anticipate. And then, Memphis didn't grow much at all. And, you know, how much of that is real and how much of that is COVID? It's hard to say at this point.
There was, you know, and it's, Stephanie's point is great, because when you think about the some of the things that the Census Bureau was going to do that were impacted by COVID to try to go into these undercounted areas, there was a thing called a mobile question assistance center, where they were going to set up it kind of where the naturally occurring places where people gather, which would be like grocery stores or a community festival. I actually saw one in a McDonald's in Hartsville, Tennessee, trying to get people to complete a form right there in person. And, you know, and the second aspect of it was things like the college operation, where they go into to the off-campus areas around houses in May to try, or in even late April, to try to start collecting responses from those college students before they leave. And in this year, those students were leaving campus just about the times the forms arrived because of COVID. And so, yeah, the jury is still out on the overall quality, but that was probably the off-campus college count is certainly one area that we're interested in looking at, but the broader undercounts and information on that may not be available for a while yet.
And I would think that any group count of the census was affected by the pandemic. I mean, we saw nursing homes amazingly affected by the pandemic.
And that's another aspect of our work with the FSCPE, the Federal State Cooperative for Population Estimates, was in August, we were intended to have a chance to get into the enumeration files and look and see what the Census Bureau had counted and had not counted in group quarters. And where they hadn't counted, we were going to be able to give them the opportunity to compile a new contact list, get them in contact with the Census Bureau so that could occur. But that operation was actually canceled. Because of issues related to, I don't know actually all the reasons, but that operation was ultimately canceled. We weren't able to conduct it. So one of the things that may occur, you know, that's being tossed around is this idea that when they open the challenge process for the highest elected officials at state, at the city and county level, they may open it to state somehow to be able to go in and provide additional administrative records from group quarters facilities that may have been missed since we didn't get that opportunity the first time around last August.
That, wow. So, okay, how often do we, I mean, again, all of this information sort of has to be clarified and confirmed by the end of January by the federal government. So do we just, for the next 10 years, are we going to try to really shore up the information that we're missing now? Or will that eventually end and the Census Bureau will just turn its attention to how do we improve counts the next time around? How do we make it more accessible? How do we, you know, try to keep some of these things from falling through the cracks? Like they seem to every census.
Well, there's a lot of actors involved here. So the census has just completed the post-enumeration survey, which gives them a good estimate of the undercount. And then when that comes out, then usually what we see is a lot of lawsuits, right? So, you know, cities like Los Angeles and Miami and so forth can always be expected to sue the federal government because of the impact of the undercount. And so you'll see some of that kind of thing. So the Census Bureau can't just say, okay, now we're done and we move on, because they'll have to deal with those kinds of things. But you know, the Census Bureau is, as Nicholas and Tim note, constantly testing things, always working to improve counts. You know, there's a reason we have the best census in the world, and it is because of the work that's being done every day by members of the Census Bureau to see how we can get it right, how we can do things better.
Well, let's talk a little bit about funding. This is a major question. It's a lot of money. Nicholas, as you said, I think the last thing I read was it's $1.5 trillion at least that is apportioned from the federal government, comes to Tennessee, and then gets doled out all over the state. So let's talk about how that works. We did see our metro areas grow. We've seen lots of decline in population in rural areas. How will all that affect funding for the state?
There's two ways to look at the question about funding. The first is, I think, looking at federal funding. Okay. And how direct are the lines between population and federal funding? And a lot of times these data are being used in various sorts of formulas. And so a really simple one might be thinking about something like per capita income. So if you know the aggregate income, the sum of everyone's income, and then you divide it by a population, you get a per capita income. If that population's lower and you have an undercount, that would make the per capita income go up. And maybe if you set a program based on some sort of per capita income, fewer people will be eligible. And so I really think that a lot of the things that happen when there is miscounts or undercounts really occur on the margins. And you know, it might be some sort of program eligibility. It might be something like just small things that might go unnoticed. But one of the things that really jumped out at me is the city of Spring Hill, Tennessee, which has grown leaps and bounds, which is in Middle Tennessee. They're in Williamson and Maury County. They just, by five people, surpassed 50,000 people. And that makes them eligible to run their own community development block grant program. And if were they not, they'd be participating in the state's program. The state's program for community development block grant money is more aimed at infrastructure improvements in communities. And when a local government runs it, oftentimes they're more aimed at affordable housing programs. So it opens a different avenue for them having reached that point. But it's certainly important. And then at the state level, the distribution of the state shared revenues to the municipalities is actually much more direct line that you can measure with population. And the Municipal Technical Advisory Service puts out a number to help communities plan on the municipal level what the impact or what the population counts will mean to their budgets every year. And they estimate that this year that a per capita number, a per person number, is $153 in state shared revenues flowing for every person. And so it's really easy to measure the someone not being counted, or it's $153 every year per person. So it is important from that standpoint.
But I think there's also a real demographic issue that goes beyond just the distribution of money, which is when we're seeing all this rural population decline, what's happening there is it's young people that are leaving. So it's not just, oh, the numbers are getting smaller. It's also that the rural populations are getting older. And of course, older populations have a lot more needs. And so when you have more and more older people without working age people to support them, to provide the infrastructure for transportation, for healthcare, and so forth, it creates a lot of genuine new social problems.
More older people and fewer young nurses is not a good recipe for success for a place.
And we already saw the adult population grow and the birth rate is down, and that's nationwide. I'm assuming that's in Tennessee as well. Yeah. Okay. So we're waiting to see what the funding is going to look like. We're waiting to see what redistricting is going to look like. Tim or Nicholas, do either one of you want to take a crack at sort of explaining from a mechanical point of view how the redistricting process is going to work for the state? I've been doing a few interviews on this. I'm doing a series of interviews on redistricting from the viewpoints of different people who are sort of involved. And what I can tell is that there's little or no public oversight on it, except for what the powers that be let, in. They let you watch from a distance. But I'm really very unclear as to how, the population at large has any effect on this at all.
That's the political component. And so we'll talk only about the mechanical component.
Okay, that's fine.
And the mechanical component is simply how the population within districts has changed over the 10-year period. And the question is the population within those districts balanced? Is it roughly equal Given that communities don't grow the same pace all across an area, that it does tend to vary, how out of whack are the populations relative to an ideal population? So the ideal population is really an easy number. It's just the total number of the total population divided by the number of districts you have. And then when you total the population inside that district, then you can see what its deviation is. And then when you come up with, if a district is 110,000 and the ideal population is 100,000, that's a 10% deviation. When you add up the district with the highest population and district with the lowest population, you get something called an overall range. So if the smallest one is 90,000, the biggest one is 110,000, that's an overall range of 20%. The standard is 10%. So the process that goes on is redrawing a new set of districts that will create an overall range in the size of those districts that's about 10%, which means that we need to have the biggest one be no more than 105,000 people and the smallest one no smaller than 95,000 people. And that's kind of the starting point for a redistricting plan, is just trying to get those numbers balanced.
So let me clarify one thing though first, but then Nicholas, yes. Does that mean that it doesn't matter what a population of a county is, that variance is generalized to a point that ratio of districts and population, you can calculate it any way for the county, and it will still be sort of the same? Do you see what I'm saying? I know I'm not explaining it very well.
There's no formula for how we redistrict. What we have are decades and decades of court rulings on kind of principles for doing it. And the federal government has left it up to each state for how they want to actually implement it. And with the courts, it's kind of a game of whack-a-mole, because states seem to be endlessly inventive in finding new ways of playing within the rules set by courts to get to certain political outcomes.
Okay, so yeah, clear as mud. We're waiting. We're waiting to see what they do, and we're waiting for public meetings to start, and we'll do that. So in the time that we have left, we have about 8 minutes left, and I really want to hear, one, if there's something that we haven't talked about yet that you really want to bring up, and two, your own research. How are you using census data in your own research, each of you? Please, any of you, feel free.
I think the one thing that, without becoming, too technical of a demographer here, is we've had this thing for a long time called population momentum, which just means that the population will continue to grow even when birth rates decline. And the reason we've had that is, of course, you have baby boomers, right? And they were, the children of parents who had 4 and 5 kids. And even though the baby boomers themselves only had 2 kids, because there were so many of them, right? So that just kept the population growing. Now we're at the point where we're actually starting to see that population momentum slow down and the population really starting to, we're still growing, but we're growing at a much slower rate, and eventually we will likely stop growing. And that has implications for everything in our society. And so we can see it looking at, countries in Europe. Many countries in Europe are already facing this. Yeah. And so all the aging population programs, and this makes immigration policy even more important. And I'm, somewhat pessimistic about ever getting any kind of immigration reform that we could really use to our benefit, that would allow us to keep a vibrant working age population to offset some of the population aging that we're seeing.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I know that was a definite data point in the census, was how much immigration policy affected the growth of the nation and Tennessee. Nicholas and Tim.
Sure. My own research revolves around how do we find out what's happening in really small places. I'm a geographer, so I want to know what's happening in a neighborhood. And the problem with finding out what's happening in a small place is that it's a small place. There aren't many people. And so inherently, there's a lot of uncertainty about that. And so one of the things that really fascinates me about what's going forward in the census is how these questions around privacy and adding data that I talked about, how this is going to impact how I do things as a geographer going forward. Am I still going to be able to find out what's happening in a neighborhood? And I don't know the answer to that right now. It's a new ballpark for me. And it's really interesting to see how the new data and concerns about privacy are going to change how we do things as scientists in the community.
Maybe more on the ground research, right? Going and doing oral histories and actually speaking face to face, or?
I would love to see more of our students thinking about how to engage with the quantitative and the qualitative aspects of finding out about community.
Tim. Oh, we lost Tim. He's gone. He left us. All right. Well, again, we have a few minutes left. So, Stephanie, is there something specific that you've been looking at besides immigration policy? I mean, one of the things that was most interesting to me. I mean, I knew that the birth rate had shrunk and that the adult population was growing. One of the other things I saw was that the Sun Belt states, so that's the West and the South where we are, it's now 62% of the population of the nation.
Yeah, that's a long-term trend going on since the 80s people have been moving west really since the beginning, but of our country, but been moving to the South since the 80s, and that, you know, continues to be the trend, and it has to do with, you know, our changing economy. It has to do with unionization, things of that nature. So that, you know, that hasn't changed. That's just part of something going on for a long time. But, you know, the West and the South are also, you know, the most, you know, racially diverse areas too. And so, you know, and so that also, you know, the movements to the South and to the West probably also contribute to the real increase in mixed race population that we're seeing.
I'm going to be really interested to see how that is affected by climate change as well, whether or not climate change has any effect on that. Yeah, Nicholas, what were you saying?
I said that growth to the South is really lumpy as well. I mean, the places that are growing are a few very large metropolitan areas, your Charlottes, your Atlantas, and your Nashvilles. So a lot of the growth to Tennessee has been to Middle Tennessee and specifically to the areas around Nashville.
Yeah. Tim, welcome back.
Unexplained drop.
And so tell us about your research and how you use this data.
Well, I mean, we're interested in population change across the state as a whole. And so we'll dig into some of the issues regarding rural population loss a little bit more to try to quantify that. You know, one of the things that we noted is that over the last decade, 29 of the 30 counties that lost population in Tennessee were rural. And so we'll want to try to understand that. We're also kind of interested in issues related to in-migration into the state and the flow of people to Tennessee and whether or not that's changing. There's a lot of speculation that it's increasing, but to the extent that it is and where it's happening is something that we're interested in learning a little bit more about as well.
Was there a period when there was a lot of movement to rural areas, or has it always been sort of this trickle from rural areas to metro?
In the 70s, we had this phenomena called the urban-rural turnaround, right? And demographers were all convinced that everybody's decided that rural life was better and people were leaving urban places and going to rural places. It didn't last very long, right? So by the, you know, it was a very brief phenomenon. And by the 80s, you know, it's, you know, there's just fewer economic opportunities in rural areas, and we just live in a different kind of world. And so, you know, for people to have good jobs, you know, I mean, for people to get an education, they have to often move out of rural communities. To get a good job, they have to move out of rural communities. If they need access to good healthcare, they often have to move out of rural communities. I mean, even a lot of rural hospitals, rural places, even if they have hospitals, don't have any surgeons working in those hospitals. So it's it's harder to sustain the economic viability of rural places, unfortunately.
Yeah. And again, that's something else that we're going to see changes in as connectivity improves, hopefully as, you know, as rural healthcare improves as well. That's, I mean, that's, all of this is interconnected. So over the next decade, maybe in 10 years, the four of us will sit down again and talk about this. I hope
so. In East Tennessee, it may be even a little artificial because you have a lot of people with, you know, with Norris Lake and that, you have a lot of people who have summer homes and so forth in the area that spend a lot of money in the rural areas, but they're not counted there. So on the census, they show up as not there. They're getting counted in Ohio or elsewhere, but they are actually here some of the year and they are actually spending.
I want to thank our guests today, Stephanie Bohan, professor and head of the UT Department of Sociology, Nicholas Nagel, professor and head of the UT Department of Geography, and Tim Kuhn, director of the Tennessee State Data Center at the Center for Business and Economic Research here on the UT campus. If all of you would please hang out for a moment so we can say a proper goodbye. Thank you to Greg Hill for production and to all of you for listening. This episode will be on our website, wuot.org, in just a bit. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. Nice to be with you. Dialogue is a production of WUOT News.